Part 3. Climate Side Effects. Chapter 7. The Enormous Power of Fossil-Fueled Climate Mastery. How to Evaluate Rising CO2 Levels. Here's where we are. The purpose of this book is to give you what our anti-human impact, anti-energy knowledge system won't. A full context evaluation of continuing fossil fuel use, including both its full benefits and its full negative side effects, from a human flourishing perspective. In part 2, we found that, contrary to our knowledge system's portrayal of the benefits of continuing fossil fuel use as trivial and easily replaceable, the ultra-cost-effective energy we get from fossil fuels is fundamental to the unnatural, amazing livability of our world, and not only irreplaceable in the coming decades by alternatives, but actually needed in growing quantities to make the world more livable for more people. We found that the benefits of ultra-cost-effective fossil fuel energy not only overwhelm its side effects, but they also reduce its negative side effects and/or neutralize their negativity over time, meaning that we can expect fossil fuel side effects to get better over time, not worse. The one possible exception to this expectation is any negative climate impacts of fossil fuels' CO2 emissions, because these emissions, one, aggregate over time, in contrast to others that quickly disappear, and two, cannot be reduced at low cost using any current or expected methods. Thus, it is crucial to evaluate fossil fuels' CO2 side effects going forward, which is the purpose of this part of the book, but to do so on the human flourishing framework, not the anti-impact framework that we have seen over and over drive our knowledge system to ignore the benefits of fossil fuels and catastrophize their side effects, in both cases wildly distorting reality and the state of science to do so. Our knowledge system tells us that rising CO2 levels will absolutely destroy the livability of our world. It tells us this so often and so vehemently that 4 in 10 Americans think there is more than a 50% chance that global warming will lead to the extinction of the human race. But we know that the same knowledge system telling us that rising CO2 levels will destroy the livability of our world denies the fact that the unprecedented livability of our world as we know it depends on the fossil fuels our knowledge system is trying to eliminate. And we know that the same knowledge system telling us that rising CO2 levels will destroy the livability of our world has been claiming for 50 years that some side effect or another of fossil fuels, resource depletion, pollution, cooling, now warming, will destroy the livability of our world. We know that the root of these distortions by our knowledge system is the anti-impact framework. Our knowledge system denies the fossil-fueled increase in the livability of our world by the standard of human flourishing because our knowledge system is not applying the standard of human flourishing. It is applying the standard of eliminating human impact, which causes it to view the amazing world fossil fuels have created as immoral because it involves so much impact on nature. And our knowledge system keeps falsely predicting catastrophe because, one, by the standard of eliminating human impact, our unnaturally livable world is a catastrophe, and two, it is operating on the delicate nurturer assumption, which causes it to assume that fossil fuels' significant impacts on nature must destroy a non-existent delicate balance, and us with it. The fact that our knowledge system is systematically distorted by the anti-impact framework doesn't mean we can dismiss concerns about fossil fuels' side effect of rising CO2 levels. It means that we need to be sure to evaluate rising CO2 levels using the human flourishing framework, not the anti-impact framework. As I discussed in Chapter 3, and will elaborate here, a proper evaluation of rising CO2 levels on the human flourishing framework requires factoring in three key variables that our knowledge system either ignores or distorts. 1. The overall benefits of fossil fuels to human flourishing, the focus of Part 2. 2. The climate mastery benefits of fossil fuels that will come with rising CO2 levels, which can potentially neutralize and overwhelm many negative climate impacts, the focus of this chapter. 3. The climate impacts of rising CO2 levels from a human flourishing perspective, including negative, neutral, and positive impacts, the focus of chapters 8 and 9. Factoring in the overall benefits of fossil fuels to human flourishing. Factoring in the overall benefits of fossil fuels has been accomplished by Part 2. The takeaway is this: the benefit of continuing fossil fuel use is the continuation of the low-cost, reliable, versatile, global-scale energy production that makes this naturally deficient and dangerous planet truly livable for billions of people, and is needed to make it truly livable for billions more. All things being equal, therefore, we should eagerly seek to dramatically increase the use of fossil fuels around the world and cease all existing and proposed restrictions beyond reasonable laws limiting pollution. There is only one hypothetical situation that could justify restricting, let alone rapidly eliminating, fossil fuel use around the world. If the side effect of rising CO2 levels from fossil fuel CO2 emissions causes climate changes so catastrophic or apocalyptic that they would be worth the guaranteed catastrophe of restricting fossil fuel use, or the apocalypse of rapidly eliminating it. Restricting fossil fuel use means mass energy deprivation. It means millions of people will die of starvation or malnutrition who otherwise wouldn't. It means billions of people continuing to do their heating and cooking with wood or animal dung. It means billions of people will have far less opportunity to experience the joys of meaningful work, family, passions, and nature. It means slowing the rate of progress for everyone, which means that you or someone you love will die earlier for lack of a medical cure that could have been ready but wasn't. And that's just restricting fossil fuel use. Rapidly eliminating fossil fuel use, as so many countries have officially committed to doing, if and where enacted, would mean the retrogression of empowered countries from nourishing, safe, opportunity-filled places to worse than Venezuela-style poverty, vulnerability, and misery. Recall that our knowledge system's attitude toward rapidly eliminating fossil fuel use is that even if there are no problems from rising CO2 levels, it's still worth doing. The proper attitude is that restricting, let alone eliminating, fossil fuel use would be so catastrophic for billions of people that it's almost impossible to imagine a set of climate-related problems that would justify it, particularly because climate danger has plummeted, not increased, as fossil fuel use and CO2 levels have risen. It becomes even more difficult when we factor in the next variable that our knowledge system ignores: the climate mastery benefits that will come with rising CO2 levels. The climate impacts of rising CO2 levels don't exist in isolation. They are a side effect of continuing fossil fuel use, which will, as I discussed briefly in chapters 2 and 4, and will discuss extensively in this chapter, mean more ability to master climate danger. The state of our climate mastery abilities determines which kinds of climate impacts are negative and which are positive. For example, in places with no climate mastery, the phenomenon of snow is a horrific danger that destroys food supplies and contributes to sickness and death. In places with climate mastery, such as Park City, Utah, snow is not just a lesser danger, it is a massive benefit. The state of our climate mastery abilities also determines the magnitude of negative climate impacts. For example, a zero-degree day is a negative in most places for most purposes, but with modern homes built, insulated, and heated with fossil fuels, it barely causes an inconvenience. In unempowered places, it can mean rapid death. Thus, we cannot properly evaluate the climate impacts of rising CO2 levels without first understanding the climate mastery abilities that will come with them. That will tell us which kinds of climate impacts we have reason to be concerned about and which kinds we don't. The climate impacts of rising CO2 levels understood without anti-impact bias. Once we understand the climate mastery benefits that come with rising CO2 levels, we of course also need to understand the climate impacts, impacts on temperatures, storms, droughts, wildfires, and so on. While this is a question our knowledge system acknowledges, actually obsesses over, a proper answer requires approaching the question using the human flourishing framework. This means not treating human impact on climate as intrinsically immoral, as the anti-impact framework's goal of eliminating human impact causes us to. It means being open not only to negative or neutral impacts on climate, but also to positive ones, such as warmth in dangerously cold places or increased fertilization of plants. CO2 is plant food. Being on the human flourishing framework also means not treating human impact on climate as inevitably self-destructive to us, as the anti-impact framework's delicate nurture assumption causes us to do. It means following the evidence to see what the actual magnitude of negative, neutral, or positive impacts is. I believe that anyone who evaluates fossil fuel CO2 side effects on the human flourishing framework will come to completely reject our knowledge system's claim of apocalyptic climate danger, which is used to justify rapidly eliminating fossil fuels. Instead, they will come to the conclusion, as I have, that fossil fuels' contribution to climate mastery is so enormous, and the actually likely negative impacts of CO2 so limited, that climate apocalypse is impossible. And that by far the most likely scenario is a continued decrease in climate danger, along with all the other benefits of fossil fuels. And they will come to the conclusion that today's claims of climate apocalypse are, like the catastrophe predictions of the past, not objective science on a pro-human framework, but distortions of science on the anti-impact framework. The dangerous, diverse, and dynamic global climate system. To understand both the climate mastery benefits, this chapter, and the climate impacts, chapters 8 and 9, that will come with rising CO2 levels, we first need to understand some basics about what climate is and how it works. Today's discussion of climate tends to use climate-related terminology very sloppily, including the climate and climate change, and it tends to be completely saturated with the delicate nurture assumption, which, applied to climate, trains us to think of climate as naturally safe and stable until human impact ruins it. Let's address both of these, starting with some clear terminology that is crucial to identifying different aspects of climate and our relationship to climate. These terms are atmosphere, weather, climate, global climate system, global climate change, human climate impact, greenhouse gases, and climate mastery. Atmosphere. The mixture of gases around the Earth held in place by its gravitational field. The atmosphere consists largely of nitrogen, 78%, and oxygen, 21%, with much smaller amounts of argon, 0.94%, and carbon dioxide, 0.04%. It is a fascinating fluid system that interacts with the heat of the sun, the water of the oceans, and the plant life on the Earth's surface to produce all different kinds of local weather conditions around the globe. Weather. The atmospheric conditions, especially temperatures and precipitation in a given area at a given time. Climate. The longer term, usually 30-year, weather trends in a given region, including what range of temperatures there is and what frequency and range of precipitation there is. Global climate system. The sum total of the planet's diverse climates, from the hottest parts of Africa to the coldest parts of Antarctica, from the wettest regions of Earth to the driest. global climate change, a significant change in the global climate system and its diverse subclimates, such as a significant rise or fall in the average of temperatures around the globe. When scientists talk about climate change, they are referring to global climate change. The classic example of global climate change is entering or exiting an ice age, such as the last ice age, when average temperatures were 6 degrees Celsius, 11 degrees Fahrenheit, lower than our current interglacial period. Human climate impact. An impact on any part of the global climate system, including the system as a whole, caused by human activity. I strongly prefer using the term human climate impact, man-made climate impact, or climate impact to climate change when discussing the impacts of rising CO2 levels, because climate change makes it unclear whether humans are causing the change. I also prefer specifying the magnitude of climate impact, for example, mild, catastrophic, as against the practice of using climate change to be totally unclear about whether one is talking about mild or catastrophic change, such as in the popular but empty refrain, climate change is real. Greenhouse gases. A popular term to describe a class of gases, technically called infrared absorbers, which slow the release of heat on Earth into the atmosphere. CO2 is by far the most important man-made greenhouse gas, and for simplicity's sake, I will use CO2 emissions and rising CO2 levels interchangeably with greenhouse gas emissions and rising greenhouse gas levels. Climate mastery. The ability of human beings, empowered by machine labor, to neutralize climate dangers, such as neutralizing storms by building sturdy buildings and powering storm warning systems, and or enhance climate benefits, such as capturing ample rainfall in a reservoir for future use. Now that we have some clear terminology to work with, let's establish three attributes of the global climate system that are obscured or denied by our anti-impact knowledge system's delicate nurturer portrayal of climate. The global climate system is naturally 1, dangerous, 2, diverse, and 3, dynamic. Understanding these is essential to understanding both climate mastery going forward and the climate impact of rising CO2 levels going forward. Dangerous. It is common to refer vaguely and affectionately to the climate as if it were a safe phenomenon. For example, John Kerry describes the atmosphere, absent human impact, as trapping the sun's heat and warming the surface of the Earth to the ideal, life-sustaining temperature. But as I indicated in Chapter 4, and will detail later in this chapter, climate everywhere is a massive natural danger to human life. Dangerous temperatures, drought, wildfires, storms, floods, and so on exist in every part of the global climate system. The natural danger of climate has several important implications for understanding climate mastery and climate impact. 1. We should not take for granted how much climate mastery is helping us today. The fact that climate can be portrayed as safe is testament to how unnaturally safe we are from climate, thanks to climate mastery. If climate mastery is keeping us safe from massive natural climate danger, that means it has a massive ability to neutralize potential man-made climate danger in the future. 2. We need to be careful not to falsely ascribe climate dangers to our impacts. Because of the dogma that climate is naturally safe, there is a widespread tendency, whenever some undesirable climate phenomenon occurs, to assume that human impact must be to blame. But if we recognize massive natural climate danger, we are completely open to the possibility that any given undesirable climate phenomenon was not caused by us. 3. We should think of potential global climate change from human impact as a change, not from safe to dangerous, but from dangerous to dangerous. We are taught to think of climate change as binary. We had a good climate, and we changed it to a bad climate. But if we recognize the natural danger of the global climate system, we see that any significant human impacts on the climate are not taking a naturally safe global climate system and changing it to an unnaturally dangerous one, but rather taking one dangerous global climate system and changing it into another dangerous global climate system. The new climate system could be more dangerous overall or less dangerous overall, and we should not assume either one. Diverse. It is common to talk of the climate as a uniform phenomenon, as in, we've broken the climate, or we've destroyed the climate. Designated experts will often portray climate as uniform when they lovingly discuss the Holocene, the 11,000-plus-year post-Ice Age stretch during which prosperity emerged. Revealingly, they love to attribute modern prosperity, which has emerged over the last 200 years, to an 11,000-year-old natural phenomenon, even though it directly correlates to the 200-year-old man-made phenomenon of skyrocketing fossil fuel use, which they condemn and seek to destroy. Just like us, says Bill McKibben, our crops are adapted to the Holocene, the 11,000-year period of climatic stability we're now leaving in the dust. McKibben's characterization portrays the Holocene as some uniformly desirable state for growing crops and many other things, and global climate change as meaning a change from this uniformly desirable state to a uniformly undesirable state. In reality, the global climate system is enormously diverse, full of desirable and undesirable atmospheric conditions at any given time. For example, the Holocene is not a particular climate anyone lived in. It is a summary of a climate system that contains an enormously diverse set of climates that individuals have lived in. The United States alone is home to every type of climate imaginable, from polar Alaska to desert-filled California to swampy Florida. The diversity of climate has important implications for understanding climate mastery and climate impact. 1. We should not underestimate how diverse a range of climates climate mastery can make livable. If we are already flourishing in an enormous range of climates, that means we will be able to handle many varieties of local and global climate changes going forward. 2. Any impact we have on the global climate system will be diverse, affecting different climates in different ways, some for better, some for worse. The idea that a man-made climate impact could be uniformly bad is based on delicate nurturer dogma, not science. There is no way a human change to a diverse system, such as the global climate system, could be uniformly negative, though it could be mostly negative or mostly positive. Dynamic. Talk about climate change usually assumes that climate is stable and then climate change destabilizes it. For example, Bill McKibben referring to the Holocene as a period of climatic stability. While climate scientists can validly refer to a period of climatic stability if there is no significant general trend in the trajectory of the world's climates, the global climate system as human beings experience it is always highly dynamic, never stable. The reason is that climate is internally dynamic. Day to day, month to month, and year to year, the weather within a given climate is changing. Weather fluctuates by many dozens of degrees, rainfall varies wildly, there are larger and smaller storms, and so on. The internally dynamic nature of climate has two important implications. 1. We should not underestimate climate mastery's ability to handle dynamic changes. The fact that we flourish under a dynamic set of climate dangers means we will be able to handle a wide variety of future dynamic dangers. 2. Any impact we have on a given climate within the global climate system will change it not from a stable state to an unstable state, but rather from one dynamic range to another. For example, a 2 degrees Fahrenheit warming in a place like Chicago with a 100-plus degree range of temperatures during the year doesn't mean Chicago is now warm. It means that if the warming were uniformly distributed, the city's temperature range would go from a climate of negative 20 degrees to 95 degrees to a climate of negative 18 degrees to 97 degrees. In addition to being internally dynamic, climate is also dynamic over time. Over long spans of time, climate changes dramatically without human impacts. Some 12,000 years ago, humans lived in an ice age, with up to 2 miles of ice covering what is now Canada. Just 20,000 years ago, sea levels were 300 feet lower than they are today. Local climate changes can happen very quickly, even without human impact. For example, there is paleoclimatological evidence for a medieval warm period in Europe between the 9th and 14th centuries, followed by a cooling that is often called the Little Ice Age. The fact that climate is dynamic over time also has two important implications. One, we cannot assume that any changes in the global climate system are necessarily due to man-made CO2. Because we know that other non-human factors contribute to climate changes, we must be open to the possibility that they, not man-made CO2, are causing a given change. And when changes are attributed to CO2, we need a clear causal explanation of why CO2 caused the changes and other factors didn't. Two, when considering predictions, we must recognize that climate is hard to model and predict. Because many factors contribute to climate changes, and because the global climate system is incredibly complex, it's hard to model its cause and effect relationships accurately and to make accurate predictions. When we hear about models and predictions, we should ask for evidence of the precision of understanding that makes accurate modeling and prediction possible. Now that we understand some essential concepts of climate and understand that the global climate system is not safe, uniform, and stable, but rather dangerous, diverse, and dynamic, we're in a much better position to answer the two questions of this part of the book. One, how powerful is fossil-fueled climate mastery at dealing with the kinds of climate dangers we're worried about, such as extreme temperatures, droughts, wildfires, storms, and floods? I'll address this question in the remainder of this chapter. Two, what are the likely impacts of rising CO2 levels, negative, neutral, and positive, on our naturally dangerous, diverse, and dynamic climate system? I'll address this question in chapters 8 and 9. How powerful is fossil-fueled climate mastery? How powerful is fossil-fueled climate mastery at dealing with climate danger? This is an essential question for evaluating the actual significance to human flourishing of any climate danger caused by rising CO2 levels, and yet our knowledge system doesn't even consider it. Observe, have you ever, in any mainstream discussion of climate change, seen any concern expressed about whether restricting fossil fuel use might increase climate danger by decreasing fossil-fueled climate mastery? I haven't. The reality of fossil-fueled climate mastery is dismissed by our knowledge system in two ways. First, our knowledge system trivializes climate mastery as mere adaptation, which is considered ignoble and superficial by our designated experts. For example, Al Gore, in his 1992 book Earth and the Balance, mocked the idea that we can adapt effectively to rising CO2 levels, saying it reflected a kind of laziness, an arrogant faith in our ability to react in time to save our skins. Adaptation is so dismissed, in fact, that it is considered perfectly acceptable to give projections of the future that explicitly don't factor in human adaptation. For example, mainstream assessments of future climate damage, including assessments by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, project a future in which humans will fail to adapt to a gradually warming environment, leading to the absurd prediction that if northern cities like Chicago warm to the level of certain southern cities today, they will experience mass heat deaths that those adaptable southern cities demonstrably don't today. Dismissing or trivializing climate adaptation, climate mastery, is like considering the danger of polio without considering the existence of a polio vaccine. The second way the reality of fossil-fueled climate mastery is dismissed by our knowledge system is that, insofar as adaptation is valued at all, it is not connected with energy, let alone with fossil fuels. Energy is treated as having only negative potential with regard to climate. It can screw up climate by emitting CO2, or it can do nothing. The mainstream knowledge system makes its unjustifiable dismissal of fossil-fueled climate mastery seem reasonable by portraying adaptation as being already overwhelmed by negative human impacts on climate. Nobel Prize-winning economist Paul Krugman writes, "While it will take generations for the full consequences of climate change to play out, there will be many localized, temporary disasters along the way. Apocalypse will become the new normal, and that's happening right in front of our eyes. The dangers of climate change are no longer predictions about the future." If adaptation is already being overwhelmed by rising CO2 levels, it's plausible to assume that our mastery abilities will be unable to handle the supposedly far worse consequences to come as CO2 levels continue to rise. As Krugman puts it, we can see the damage now, although it's only a small taste of the horrors that lie ahead. But the idea that climate danger is bad and getting worse, overwhelming our mastery abilities, is completely false. As I shared in Chapter 2, as CO2 levels have risen for the last 170 years and global temperatures have risen by an average of 1 degree Celsius, 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit, climate danger has plummeted. The best metric of climate danger is climate-related disaster deaths, a statistic that includes deaths from extreme temperatures, drought, wildfires, storms, and floods. The second best is climate damage, which I will discuss later this chapter. And the rate of climate disaster deaths has decreased by 98% over the last century, the only period for which we have decent data. To make this more concrete, the climate death rate for the 1920s is the equivalent of 1.77 million people a year today dying from climate-related disasters. And yet in the 2010s, an average of just 18,000 people a year died from climate-related disasters. In a given year, the average person's chance of dying from a climate-related disaster is about 3 in 1 million. That's 1/42nd the average person's chance of dying in an auto accident, which is about 115 in 1 million. The plummeting of climate-related disaster deaths denied by our knowledge system has two implications. One, given that rising CO2 levels correlate with dramatically decreasing climate deaths, designated experts' supposedly scientific claims of rising CO2's terribly negative long-term impacts on climate may be significantly distorted, just as designated experts' past supposedly scientific claims of terrible climate impacts have proved wildly distorted. We'll see whether that's the case in chapters 8 and 9. 2. Fossil-fueled climate mastery is an enormously powerful force that can overcome massive natural climate danger. Ultra-cost-effective fossil fuel energy powers the machines that produce unprecedented protection from climate, from construction machines that build weather-resilient buildings, to heating machines that produce warmth when it's cold, to cooling machines that produce cool air when it's hot, to irrigation machines that alleviate drought, to automobiles that enable us to evacuate areas when necessary. The high-level truth about fossil-fueled climate mastery is that it's an enormously powerful force. However, to evaluate specific types of climate impacts going forward, from temperature rises to potential sea level rises, we need to understand how powerful fossil-fueled climate mastery is for every specific type of climate danger. That way, when considering the climate impacts of rising CO2 levels, we can know which types of climate danger we don't need to worry about, because they will likely be readily masterable, and which types of climate danger we do need to worry about because they may not be masterable. I'll start with the climate danger most directly associated with rising CO2 levels, dangerous temperatures. Mastering dangerous temperatures. How significant an ability will continuing fossil fuel use give us to master dangerous temperatures? According to our knowledge system, not very much. Our knowledge system portrays dangerous temperatures, especially dangerously warm temperatures, as a catastrophic danger, already overwhelming our meager adaptation abilities. In reality, dangerous temperatures, which overwhelmingly come from too much cold, not too much heat, are a smaller danger than ever thanks to two forces: fossil-fueled climate mastery and modestly warming temperatures. Contrary to the portrayal of the unimpacted global climate system as a delicate nurturer that will be ruined by a few degrees of warming, most climates have a dynamic range of often dangerous temperatures, which are largely more dangerous at the cold end than at the warm end. For example, if you look at a chart of the range of temperatures in New York in 1919 and in 2019, you will see that the range in 2019 is only slightly higher, meaning slightly warmer lows and slightly warmer highs. Though, for reasons I'll discuss in Chapter 9, there is more rise in low temperatures than in high temperatures. But in both 1919 and 2019, human beings had to deal with a wide range of dangerous temperatures. Before human beings had fossil-fueled machines to master dangerous climates, they were overwhelmed by natural temperature dangers, both heat and, especially, cold. For example, 1911, a year when CO2 levels were at the allegedly safe level of 298 parts per million, was a particularly tragic year of heat waves, because air conditioning did not yet exist. The tragedy is captured well by a New England Historical Society story titled, "The 1911 Heat Wave Was So Deadly It Drove People Insane." A July 1911 heat wave killed thousands of New Englanders and sent many over the brink of madness. During 11 hellish days, horses dropped in the street, and babies didn't wake up from their naps. Boats in Providence Harbor oozed pitch and began to take on water. Tar in the streets bubbled like hot syrup. Trees shed their leaves, grass turned to dust, and cow's milk started to dry up. In every major northeastern city, the sweltering heat drove people to suicide. On July 4th, temperatures hit 103 in Portland, 104 in Boston, a record that still stands, 105 in Vernon, Vermont, and 106 in Nashua, New Hampshire, and Bangor, Maine. At least 200 died from drowning, trying to cool off in rivers, lakes, ponds, and the ocean, anything wet. Still more died from heat stroke. The 1911 heat wave was possibly the worst weather disaster in New England's history, with estimates of the death toll as high as 2,000. Things were even worse in Europe. In France, over 40,000 people died in a heat wave, including thousands of babies. This kind of death from heat is unimaginable in the supposedly too hot, empowered world today, thanks to the use of fossil-fueled machines to produce insulated structures and the use of modern fossil-fueled air conditioning systems, as well as the whole fossil-fueled modern medical care system, which can alleviate and cure heat-related conditions. Heat-related deaths are a much bigger problem in the unempowered world today, which is yet another reason why empowerment is a moral imperative. But contrary to the idea that warming will be deadly for the unempowered world, warming would actually help with by far the greatest temperature-related problem: cold. As bad as naturally dangerous hot temperatures are, naturally dangerous cold temperatures have long been and remain a far greater danger, Even in India, cold-related deaths significantly exceed heat-related deaths. A study over the last two decades found that deaths from cold have been many times more numerous than deaths from heat. Before modern empowerment, cold would kill many people every year by suppressing their immune systems. And when cold was particularly bad, it would be downright mass murderous. For example, the Great Frost of 1709 swept across Europe, freezing lakes, rivers, and soil up to a meter deep, and lasted 3 months. Livestock died in droves, and so did people. 2,000 Swedish soldiers died in a single night, and the cold and subsequent famine killed an estimated 600,000 in France. Such events are unimaginable in the empowered world today because we are unnaturally protected by fossil-fueled machines that enable us to master temperature. Today's enormous level of fossil-fueled temperature mastery in the empowered world has major implications for evaluating future temperature rises. First, the unempowered world needs to empower to deal with the significant threat of naturally dangerous temperatures that exists in any era. Second, warming from rising CO2 levels should be expected to lead to, on its own, an overall decline in temperature-related deaths, at least to a certain, considerably warmer point, because cold is so much greater a danger than heat. This is even more the case if we recognize that, as I will elaborate on in Chapter 9, warming of the planet tends to be concentrated in colder regions and at colder times, exactly where and when the threat of cold-related death is greatest. The only hypothetical way rising temperatures from rising CO2 levels could pose a problem is if they indefinitely, rapidly accelerate out of control. It is this kind of scenario that we should be concerned about if there proves to be evidence of it, which I will explore in Chapter 9. For now, I will just reiterate that we have had 1 degree Celsius of warming in the past 170 years of rising CO2 levels and point out that today's CO2 levels are less than 1/10 of the planet's historical high points, which were some of the most life-friendly times in the planet's history. When we hear claims of an overheated world associated with potential temperature increases, such as 2 degrees Celsius warming since pre-industrial times, which is only 1 degree Celsius warmer than today, we can be sure that we are witnessing the anti-impact framework's delicate nurture assumption driving the denial of fossil-fueled temperature mastery. Such warming on its own would be a completely negligible issue for a world that can increasingly master climate, and would quite likely lead to more of a decline in cold-related deaths than an increase in heat-related deaths. Knowing that our knowledge system consistently denies temperature mastery is crucial context to keep in mind whenever we hear claims about catastrophic temperature changes in the future. There is a very good chance those claims are based on climate mastery denial, and that without such denial, catastrophe would be implausible. Let's now look at other climate dangers, beginning with the historically most deadly type of climate-related danger, drought. Mastering drought. How significant an ability will continuing fossil fuel use give us to master future dangers from drought? According to our knowledge system, not very much. Our knowledge system portrays drought as a worse danger than ever, already overwhelming our meager adaptation abilities. But the data show that human beings in the empowered world are safer from drought than any human beings have ever been. And even those in the unempowered world enjoy unprecedented safety from drought. Worldwide, including the empowered and unempowered world, drought-related deaths, once the leading form of climate disaster death, have gone down by an incredible 99% in the last century. And reporting gaps in the data indicate that this might still be an underestimate. Why? Because climate is naturally far more dangerous drought-wise than we are taught, and our fossil-fueled climate mastery abilities are incomparably more significant than we are taught, overwhelming massive natural drought danger as well as any man-made drought danger so far. Contrary to the portrayal of the natural global climate system as a delicate nurturer with stable, sufficient rainfall, virtually every climate has dynamic and often deficient rainfall, causing droughts that unempowered people struggle and sometimes totally fail to cope with. Consider the type of drought danger that once afflicted the unempowered. From 1876 to 1878, for example, a crippling drought affected parts of 13 provinces in China and was so bad that entire lakes and rivers dried up. Somewhere between 9 and 13 million people died. According to one observer, victims knife human corpses, dig out dead bodies for sustenance, and even kill live persons as food for survival, so that 40 to 50% of the population has died of starvation. Nothing like this is imaginable today in the empowered or even the unempowered world. Why? Because the empowered world uses fossil-fueled machine labor to master naturally massive drought danger for itself and also to dramatically help the unempowered world. The number one way in which we use fossil-fueled machine labor to master drought is through irrigation. Historically, the phenomenon of insufficient water was, and in much of the unempowered world, still is, one of the deadliest threats. Without enough water, crops die and people starve. Enter irrigation systems. Irrigated lands average more than 3 times the crop yields of rain-fed areas. Sometimes irrigation can rely on gravity to move water, but when it can't, irrigation takes a lot of energy, usually fossil fuel energy, to move the water. Irrigation systems utilize electricity-based, usually fossil fuel-dominated, or diesel-based machines to increase the amount and reliability of water going to crops. And irrigation systems are produced by myriad fossil fuel-powered machines, such as mining equipment, steel furnaces, and assembly machines. By powering irrigation machines and the machines that produce irrigation infrastructure, fossil fuels enable the empowered world to be unnaturally hospitable to crops, even when nature is at its harshest. Another use of fossil-fueled machines to counter drought, one that has been particularly beneficial to the unempowered world, is drought relief transportation. Today, if there is a giant crop failure in a poor part of Africa or Asia, we can use our fossil-fueled transportation system to move crops from the places in the world with the most food production to those that are stricken by drought. For example, in 2017, the U.S. provided nearly $170 million in aid to Ethiopia and Kenya to help with drought relief. Much of that money was used to bring large amounts of food to a remote part of eastern Ethiopia with little infrastructure, which required heavy-duty fossil-fueled transport to reach. If fossil fuel use continues and expands, drought mastery will continue and expand. Drought mastery is so powerful that it's extremely hard to imagine climate impacts from rising CO2 levels that could overwhelm the drought protection abilities of an empowered world. This is even more the case because continuing and expanding fossil fuel use can and will drive improvements in the ultimate drought-fighting technique, desalination. Desalination technology takes seawater and transforms it into water that is drinkable and/or usable for agriculture. For example, the Sorek desalination plant in Israel uses a filtering technology called reverse osmosis, which filters the salt out of the seawater with a membrane. The facility produces 10% of the country's drinking water consumption and about 20% of its domestic water consumption. The potential of desalination was perhaps best captured by the comedian and podcast host Joe Rogan. In response to claims that California's almost out of water, Rogan commented, "We're right next to the ocean. What the fuck are you talking about? Look at all that water. You fly over it, it takes a day. The world's blue. It's more water than it is not water. We have a salt problem. We don't have a water problem. Suck the salt out of the water, we got a goddamn party." That party is growing, thanks to the world's massive fossil fuel use. we must keep in mind the enormous power of fossil fuel drought mastery, which is widely ignored or denied, as we consider any negative drought-related impacts of rising CO2 levels going forward. When we hear about catastrophic drought going forward, it is very likely another instance of climate mastery denial.